Hi again. The original plan was for me to be talking about antibiotics and the stuff we've been doing on antibiotic treatment and the stuff we've been doing on mechanisms of action of bacteriostatic antibiotics. But Boris pointed out that really isn't consistent, very consistent with the base theme of this meeting. And so what I'm going to do instead is going to talk about the phage, which is much more consistent. For those that are interested in drugs, I mean antibiotics, you want to be very specifically, unless you want to try and sniff macrolides. If there isn't time for a regular talk, we can work out an informal time for those that are interested in the antibiotic stuff, which is very cool, of course. But this also has the virtue of the work I'm presenting is still underway. Just as I'm talking, things are like shaking in flasks and colonizing petri dishes and things of that sort. Therefore, it'd be more useful to me. Your feedback would be more useful to me. I'm going to talk about phage in a variety of ways. Google Hangout is important for us. I mean, we collaborate with people in various places, particularly in Spain and Vienna, Austria, and so on. And Google Hangout has totally changed how one does collaboration and research. I mean, Skype would be also. You could just work. We haven't gotten to the point of being able to share coffee or beer, but maybe soon. We tried downloading it, and it just messed up the computer. All right. Remember, I have hearing issues. Anytime you want to say anything, please say it loudly. Okay. Yeah. You know, this whole bullshit about the most abundant organisms on Earth. I always like that. If I'm talking about CRISPR, start out as an adaptive immune system. It doesn't. What are we? Anyway, I don't know where they got these numbers, but I got them from the web. But really, we know almost nothing about what phage are doing in natural populations. A lot of descriptive work. Forrest Rauer is closest to doing much of it, but we really don't know very much about what the most abundant organisms on Earth are about doing. The question is, do they regulate the densities? And it's really important for understanding microbiomes. People will say, are they doing anything for affecting the distribution and densities of bacteria in microbiomes? We really don't know the answer to that. And so I think it's a really important question to get out there beyond the flasks and so on. And what about the species and strain composition? What effect are the phage having on that? What is the contribution of phage to horizontal gene transfer? We know there's all kinds of horizontal gene transfer, but are the phage doing it? And how are they doing it? What are the conditions under which phage will be maintained in bacterial populations? That's going to be the primary focus of what I'm going to be talking about. And then I'm going to also look at the temperate and lytic modes of phage replication, the question of why be temperate, which it sounds like it's something from the 1920s or something. But I'm going to bring that up again, the lysogeny. So the first part of the talk was on the population dynamics, that we're going to come out with a leaky resistance hypothesis, and then say a few things about the why be temperate question. And then if time permits, I will talk about phage and the epidemiology of cholera. It's sort of funny, I mean, yesterday I was talking about Hankin and the discovery of phage by Hankin. And I reread Hankin's paper in preparation for that. And really, there were some really cool things in that paper. It was suggesting that phage were, in fact, regulating the incidence of cholera. So I came back to some old stuff that we had done. And if time permits, I'll go and say something about it. When I'm using the phrase we, I still pipette, I want you to know that. But much of the work I'm going to be talking about today It was done by Waqas Chowdhury, who was a graduate student from Islamabad who did his work in my lab. Nalong Shah is an awesome Emory undergraduate. Marish Pleska is from the IST, Institute of Science and Technology in Vienna, and has been doing some really cool stuff on the role of restriction modification on temperate phage, and he joined us in this project. Ingrid McCall is my awesome lab manager, just great. Howie Weiss is a mathematician. You really should have at least one mathematician in your group. And this is Jim Bull and his normal guys, and this is Jim Bull at the National Academy. And this is a very, I use this, Jim's idea. Jim has taken pretension to new lows. If you know Jim Bull, you'll appreciate what I say. He's just great. I mean, he's just really terrific. Anyway, so we've worked on phage for varieties of time together.
But now you're officially a physicist.
Yeah.
The difference between physicists and biologists, the physicists do acknowledgments at the beginning of the talk.
Yeah. Anyway, so this year, and we can talk about it later, we've gotten into people who've been treated with a bacteriophage and phage therapy. And one of them, again, was in Tbilisi. Actually, I had been in Tbilisi, and he brought us back all of these therapeutic phage. And we're interested in it as a supplement to antibiotics. So for those that are interested in these stories, so we've spoken to people who are being treated with phage this year. They've come for lunch and things like that. And it's sort of because of the big resistance concern, there's a lot of new interest in using phage therapeutically. And Durell, and there was a lot of, the question is, you know, there hasn't been really good control studies, but around 1990, there were about 400 people working in Tbilisi producing phage that were going all over the former Soviet Empire and used for therapy and prophylaxis. The question is, was it any good? And that's something I do want to. This is Waqas, and we recently published a paper on the synergistic effects of using phage to deal with biofilm populations of bacteria. That is to say, the phage helped break up the biofilms and make the antibiotics that much more effective. And so there's a kind of interesting issue there. And so we could talk about it in terms of the practicality of getting phage seriously considered, which is one of our, you know, I'm not going to advocate phage, but I think I'm going to advocate really serious consideration of phage, which is what's missing. That is, you know, and one of the things that we're particularly interested in using combinations of phage and bacteria is that to introduce a new therapy, say if a new antibiotic or something, you have to show non-inferiority. I love that phrase. I'm going to use it in when I write a lot of letters of recommendation. I'm going to sort of point out this candidate isn't bad. It's no worse than the rest. I mean, if you say her work is influential, but not as influential as Darwin, she's screwed. So just got to be careful about what you say. But anyways, what you have to show if you're introducing a new therapy is that it's no worse than the existing. You don't do for infection, you don't do placebo controls. And so what we're going to try and push is the possibility of using phage in combination with a standard procedure. And particularly interested in, Waqas was particularly interested in ulcers of diabetics, which is a major source of amputation. That is, they get these very difficult to treat skin ulcers. And using this combination. So there's a practical aspect of that, which is not what I'm going to be talking about. This is Frank Stewart, a mathematician I work with from, an assistant professor at Brown, a most wonderful person, and a wonderful human being in various ways. So there's a lot of deja vu, or you know, it's a long time ago, but at the time it felt like the present. This is, well, I'm going to talk about work that we had done, you know, that is sort of coming back to old work. And so this, we also did work on mutation and other stuff with Frank Stewart. Frank is a great, was a terrific mathematician, so a very wonderful man. One of the things, and this is particularly important for those interested in microbiomes and ecology, if we have three trophic levels, that is, if you just have competition, number of species has to be less than or equal to the number of resources, if you, in terms of necessary conditions, not sufficient, but necessary. If you add phage, or a third trophic level, it totally expands the possibility of maintaining diversity. So this is, you know, stuff coming from the, you know, before most of you were diploid, but the point is important. That is, if we're concerned with communities and we have a third trophic level, it opens the possibilities for maintaining stable communities considerably. And I think that's another element of phage that I think one should be considering, not just phage for bacteria, but also protozoa and things that are predatory. Now, this is the cycle of a lytic phage, and I'm going to consider first lytic phage. That is, and I showed this yesterday, basically the sand of interpretation is a phage converses bacteria into the machinery producing new phage, and we get lots of phage so that we have an infection, and there's a period called the latent period, and say anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour varying with the phage, and then we produce 10 to the 50 or 100 phage particles, and the cells die and the phage. And then there's temperate phage, where we have, most of the time we're going through this lytic cycle. That is, but there's a probability of, say, 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 2, that the phage genome will be incorporated into the bacterial genome, and it will be transmitted vertically. And the lysogens, the ones that are carrying what we can call a prophage, are now immune to superinfection. And as I mentioned yesterday, the prophage carry often increase the fitness of the bacteria in a variety of ways, including this whole question of production of toxins and things like that. So the prophage can augment the fitness of the bacteria by the genes they carry, which is interesting in its own right. The virtues of temperance and lysogeny, I'm only going to talk about it with respect to phage. With the rest of your lifestyle, I'm not going to say anything about the virtues of temperance. First of all, they can be horizontally transmitted. So they can do what a lytic phage can do. They're transmitted horizontally, and they can sweep through a population. But they also can be transmitted vertically. One of the conditions for horizontal transmission is the density of bacteria necessary for the production of phage has to be high enough so that the, you know, very simple models will say, so we're talking about 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6. Below that is hard, you can't establish phage. Whereas if you transmit it vertically, you don't have this lower density threshold. So that's another virtue. And it can directly increase the fitness. So the question really is not why be temperate, is why be virulent, really? And that's the virulent caveat. That is, lytic mutants can replicate on lysogens. Would they not take over? That is, if in fact you have, I guess some people like to call it a cheater, by mutation, not in the case of, say, lambda, takes a few genes, you could generate virulent mutants, which can then kill lysogens. So now that all the lysogens are, so then lysogens become sensitive cells, whereas in the case of temperate phage, they're not sensitive. So the question is, why don't they just take over? And that's what we're going to be considering. So the issue is, while phage are commonly maintained in experimental populations, as I will point out, within short order resistance evolves. That is to say, we're asking the question, can phage regulate the densities of bacterial populations, which is what is central to this ecological question, which is central to this whole meeting. If phage can regulate the densities of bacterial populations, we have a particular story. On the other hand, what happens if resistance evolves? And then, if temperate phage exists, why aren't they replaced? I'm calling them issues in part because of a wonderful comment by Andre Leveaux, who has many wonderful comments, is that the nature does not have problems, nature only has solutions. That is, we call it, this is the problem I'm working on. It's been solved. We're just trying to figure out what the solution is. And so you got to put it in that context. This is old work, and it sort of defines the problem. This, Lin Chao will be here on Monday. Lin Chao's awesome in many ways. But this was part of Lin Chao's master's thesis, actually. His PhD thesis was on bacteriocins. And we had been doing these experiments with Frank Stewart on the conditions for the existence of bacteriophage. And this is a chemostat experiment where, in this case, these are the bacteria, these are the phage. The culture, in the absence of phage, the density would be about 5 × 10⁸. With phage, the density of bacteria is about 10⁵. And the culture is limited by phage. It looked like Lin wasn't doing anything. The culture, the chemostats were clear. But nevertheless, we could estimate the densities of bacteria and phage. All right? That's saying we have a system where it's regulated. It turns out that in terms of what is happening here, this is the phage T7. We get sensitive cells, we then get resistant mutants, and then we get host range phage. So there's a short arms race. And in this situation, we have this. We have actually two phages and two bacteria and a single resource. Then we could get another mutant of bacteria that's resistant to all the phage. And so now we have a resistant bacteria. When that occurs, so that we start the culture out, this one would start out similarly, but we never evolved the second level of resistance. In this case, we evolved the second level of resistance, so we had a phage-limited situation, and then end up with the culture dominated by resistance. So resistance dominates the population after a very short period of time. And in this case, we could get phage-limited cultures, but under these conditions, resistance evolves. The bacterial population is dominated by resistant. The phage are a minority. How are the phage maintained in this system? These are a couple of other cases. This is E. coli B. This is some work, the original paper that Frank and Lynn and I had written. We have the culture is dominated by resistant bacteria, and the phage are maintained as a minority. This is Vibrio cholerae, some work by Yan Wei. The phage resistance evolves, and the cultures are dominated by resistant bacteria, and the phage are maintained as a minority population. So this is some experiments. Yeah?
Sorry, are you going to comment on why they're maintained?
That's what the whole thing's about. So I'm just raising the question. Okay, so we have resistance evolve, and the phage cannot replicate on the resistant bacteria. That's how we're defining it. And nevertheless, they're maintained. And so the question is how.
But I guess a couple of slides before, you had this T0 and T1. So what exactly was T1?
So, well, with the 2.7, and we can maintain it as long as the second level of resistance didn't evolve. Once the second level of resistance evolved, the culture became limited by resources, and the dominant population of bacteria were resistant to all the phage in the minority population. And that seems to be the common thing we get experimentally.
Sorry to be dense here. But you have two phages. So the phage is evolving too, or?
Well, the phages are evolving. And, you know, we have an arms race, but it's a very brief arms race. What? So in the T7 case, we have the original, and then we have the phage. The first thing that evolves is a resistant bacteria. The phage then evolved host range mutants that can attack the resistant bacteria.
So maybe it's the host range mutant
of the phage.
Expression of the
right.
Understand.
But then we have another resistant mutant that now and then evolves to dominate the community.
And then the experiment stops.
No, we kept
it
going.
Could be another mutant.
There were no more mutants. That was the end of the arms race. That was it. And I'm going to talk about how it's maintained in a couple minutes. I just want to give you all the problem. That is, in all the experiments we've done, in this case, we're doing it with Pseudomonas and phage. You know, this is the bacteria, and these are the phage. In the absence of the phage, we maintain this thing. With phage, we still maintain that. In one population, the phage were lost. In the rest of the population, the phage were maintained. But the dominant population of bacteria were resistant to the phage. That is experimentally. Okay, so
Bruce, can you clarify what does resistant mean to you?
I'll do that very clearly. I'll talk about how we measure resistance, which is really critical. Okay, so this is the situation that we commonly see. So you saw it for Vibrio cholerae, you saw it for E. coli. And this is Pseudomonas. We see a similar thing. This is an experiment we did with CRISPR. This one, there's lots of coevolution occurring. This is Streptococcus thermophilus in milk. So we're growing. You know, this is really cool. You go to the supermarket and get some powdered milk, and then you just put it into the autoclave and then you have sterile milk, and then you put in really cheap, the cheapest medium we've ever had, and then they grow very well in milk, and the only problem is the next day you have yogurt. And so that when you do these experiments, you were trying to do liquid culture, and so when you do the experiments, you end up with yogurt, which is physically structured, and then you have to seriously vortex to suspend the bacteria from. And there's an underlying coevolutionary story here in that we're dealing with CRISPR, and so that we're evolving, continuously evolving mutants. We have two possibilities. If we get a spacer that the phage don't respond to, doesn't have the mutation, the phage get lost. If in fact the phage are generating the mutant, this is for CRISPR, then basically we get a situation where the culture is dominated by bacteria that are resistant, or immune in this case, to the phage, and the phage are maintained. And this is serial passage. So we get two outcomes, right? We either get the loss of the phage, or we get the continuous maintenance. And in this case, there's a lot of coevolution occurring. There's a paper by Rudolf Barringer where they've looked over years, and you see this coevolution occurring. if the phage don't get their shit together and can't generate a mutant to deal with the spacer, they get lost. But if they do, the arms race continues. And we have, so they're changing the thing that Boris wants, the phage are evolving and so on. But we don't see that occurring in most phage. In fact, there's a paper, an old paper with Rich Lenski and I in the American Naturalist, where we actually show that usually these communities end up with bacteria that are resistant to the phage, and the phage do not respond anymore. And so the question we're asking with respect to the whole question of communities, if the bacteria are resistant to the phage, then the communities are limited by resources, not by phage, but how are the phage maintained? Okay, and that's the question that we're going to, how are lytic phage maintained in communities when the bacteria are resistant? Now, we did it, this is Maylon's idea of the model, so that we have lytic phage, they absorb the sensitive cells. We're making an assumption that is going to turn out to be very important. So these are the sensitive bacteria. They produce resistance cells, and there's a continuous either transition. I'm using the word transition rather than mutation, in that they're either phenotypically or genetically, in the model, it doesn't matter. And then we assume there's a refuge, which is necessary for the modeling, and then we get lysis. We can then convert that into some simple differential equations, and so that we have the rate of change in the resource concentration, rate of change in the density of sensitive cells, the phage absorbed, so we're making the mass action assumption. This is continuous in all of our models. We're always making mass action assumptions, that the density, that the rate of absorption is proportional to the density of phage and bacteria, the product of the densities, and a rate constant. But we're also assuming that as the resource concentration gets lower, as they approach stationary phase, absorption stops. So that's why this over here is the simple Monod equation. So this is a simple model of the dynamics of phage going back to the 1970s. And so that basically we have the rate of growth of the bacteria, which depends on the concentration of resource, the rate of absorption and killing by phage, the rate of conversion, so that we lose, this is the rate of mutation or transition to resistance, and this is the rate of acquisition from resistance. This is the resistant bacteria, they're not affected by phage. They may grow at a lower maximum rate, but they're not affected by phage. They're being converted into sensitive, and then we have and then they're being produced by the sensitive. And the phage in this model are simply they're growing by absorption to sensitive cells, and there's a burst size. We have, there's a time delay differential equation, which is really a little bit inconvenient, but we've done that too. Biology is really inconvenient, and you guys must realize it more than we do. Anyways, and then, so there's the phage replication. Very simple model.
So what was the refuge that was necessary for
the refuge, you'll see, is necessary. If we don't have a refuge, we get oscillations of increasing amplitude, and the whole thing goes to pieces. So we're assuming that there's when the density of phage gets to say 10^2, when the density of bacteria gets to 10^2, the phage can't find them. It's an artifact. It's something necessary for the model. I'm not sure it's
Why do you assume that the transference between resistant bacteria and sensitive bacteria depends on the resource?
Because the growth rate depends on the resource. When the resource concentration gets lower, the bacteria. So we're trying to get the physiology in. So when bacteria at stationary phase, they don't adsorb to phage. Phage can't replicate on stationary phase bacteria. And they're also refractory to antibiotics, which is another, which is the other talk that I could talk about. So to get, to allow for that, we're assuming that the system is resource limited, if you know, and that as the resource concentration gets lower, the rate of phage replication declines. Which is reality also. It's just
all these things are proportional to phi r, right?
What?
Phi r is sort of setting a time scale, right? Because everything is proportional to phi r in this model.
Everything is proportional to psi r. The growth rate
phi
is
r, sorry.
Psi r. Whatever. yeah, the growth rate is, this was Minot. Minot, people might not know this, Minot was an ecologist. His thesis was on the growth of bacteria and the relationship between resources and growth of bacteria. Then he went astray, but he could have done some really good work if he stayed with ecology. So his thesis was on, and he showed this relationship between rates of growth of bacteria and resource concentration. And that, and it's really interesting historically. The chemistat came from that. There was Szilard, the physicist, knew of Minot's work, and Minot got together and they designed the chemistat. The idea behind the chemistat is as the bacteria grow, the resource concentration declines, and there's an equilibrium occurs when the rate of growth is equal to the rate of flow. And so the chemistat came out of Minot's thesis. And Szilard, the physicist, I guess he was involved, a nuclear physicist, one of the more interesting souls, I think. There's a wonderful biography of Szilard, who's just, I don't know. Anyway, so that's where all that comes from. All right, and these are the parameters.
So do you need to assume that the cost of the, there's a cost to resistance?
I'm sorry?
Do you need to assume that there's a cost to resistance?
We allow that. We're assuming that it's in the maximum growth rate. They have a lower maximum growth rate. And we'll talk about the cost of resistance, which are... All right, and there's a wonderful program called Berkeley Madonna, which was developed by George Oster, who's not particularly well now. But anyways, and that's what we do most of our simulations with. It's great for teaching also. Because you could get students that prefer to hum equations or have diarrhea when they see a differential equation, and you could get them to solve them, with Berkeley Madonna. So most of the simulations you're going to see are with Berkeley Madonna. This is what we would get over the short term with that model. In the absence of resistance, the phage would replicate, and the bacteria would be killed in very short order. If I allow for the refuge, and I just do this in the absence of resistance, this is sampling all the time. This is serial passage, so that we have a serial transfer model. The bacteria, every 24 hours, a fraction of the population is transferred. And this is looking at the short-term dynamics where I plot everything. And you can see the phage dominate and the bacteria maintain. I don't know, maybe, Boris, if you want to look at this, this is why we need the refuge. If I don't have the refuge, it'll oscillate all the way. And if we assume there is no resistance, so just plotting this every transfer, we get the culture dominated by phage and a minority population of sensitive bacteria. And these are the parameters. I should point out that we're constrained by the estimates of the parameters we make. So the models, one of the virtues of working with bacteria is that you could estimate the parameters independently of the, so we could estimate adsorption rates, burst sizes, latent periods. We have ways of doing all of that, and very simple. So the parameters, the range of parameters here is constrained by reality. And if resistance evolves, the prediction is the phage would be lost. And the resistant will dominate, and the sensitive cells will continue to exist, but the this is assuming no fitness cost. So the model with the parameters in the range estimated predicts that if resistance evolves, the phage will be lost. Right? We should have just published that without doing the experiments, because we could have been fine. Nobody would have known. No, I would have known. And so the experiments we did was with the phage lambda, with lysogens that are, we have a marker on lambda, so that lysogens become resistant to kanamycin. So we're able to pick up lysogens, not in an easy way. We have lambda vir can replicate on lysogens, and we have your standard E. coli. We have a streptomycin-resistant mutants, and then we picked up various mutants that are resistant to lambda vir. We're using mostly M9, which is minimal medium, with maltose. And the reason for maltose is the lambda receptors associated with maltose permease. Or LB, and I found out a few years ago, we always call this Luria broth, Luria Brittani broth. It turns out Brittani, who developed it, called it lysogeny broth. And so that's what the LB is, in case you wonder. If you also wonder why it has 5 grams of sodium chloride, that's because you want that sodium chloride for the phage. So this medium that we all use was really designed for phage work. And the technology, we did everything by serial passage in these experiments. We sometimes did chemotests, but this was all experiments. Now this is addressing Olin's point. How do we determine what is resistant? The standard approach, what people will normally do is they take the phage, and then they take the bacteria and they streak it across, and if you get a bacteria, you see no growth in an area, call that sensitive, and if you don't see it, you're calling it resistant. A much more sensitive assay would be to spot it on place. So we start out with a resistant lawn, and then you look to see if you get lysis on the lawn. You just drop the phage in there so you get the cells on a resistance. One of the problems which we dealt with is how sensitive is that assay? Well, this is suggested by Jim, is what we did was this is what we would get if we only have sensitive. This is it. What we would get if we had only 10% sensitive. So that if there was your assay is not all that precise. So, but on the other hand, it's quite clear that we can get what we're calling resistant. And so this is one of the concerns. This is a standard procedure, and we know, and it would be defined as resistant. Now, when we do the experiments with lytic phage and sensitive bacteria in the short term, what we see happening is the bacteria, this is a control, the bacteria growing, this is the phage grow up and the sensitive cells start to decline. And if in fact this is over hours, we get this kind of thing. The bacteria are cut back and then they start growing again. And if this is experimental work, in some times we get the loss of the phage over serial passage, and in some cases we're getting the maintenance of the phage. And we're getting the maintenance of the phage with a dominant population of bacteria that by our assays are resistant. So that the dominant population in these cultures are resistant. And we're getting a loss. So these are 12 independent cultures. In 7 of them we got coexistence, and in 8 of them we got coexistence, and 5 we got the loss of the phage. And when we get coexistence, it's highly stable. We could go for 30, 40 transfers and see the population dominated by resistant bacteria. So the phage will be maintained as a minority population or lost within a few transfers. So there's two outcomes that we're seeing. One is that the experiment's terminated quickly because the phage are lost, resistance ascends, and in many of the cases that they're maintained.
Bruce, do you see a correlation between the likelihood of being lost or gained and the amount of wall growth or rim growth that you have?
I think we have another explanation. We have wall. We got rid of the walls. No, we don't. I'm going to give you another. I'm going to present the hypothesis and evidence in its support for that result.
So what is the growth differential between sensitive and resistant?
Very little difference in these experiments. The resistance have very little cost, maybe less than 5%, which is really important. You'll see.
Imagine that if it's larger, it will start oscillating again.
Right, yeah. No. I mean, that's a very good point. So the hypothesis is, first of all, phage resistance engenders a fitness cost. And in our original paper, we showed that if the fitness costs, we can account for it. But as I will show experiment in our models, it requires an enormous fitness cost to get the result.
In the model you showed, there is a constant switching back and forth between resistant and sensitive. So you would always get some
Right, and that's the hypothesis we're going to argue for, is that the rate has to be very high, and you'll see. So we got to come down to the numbers count in this case, unfortunately. Well, not unfortunately, fortunately. I love the word the numbers count, but that's another matter. Okay, so one hypothesis: phage resistance engenders a fitness cost. Okay. There's a refuge on the walls of the flasks. Two postdocs in my lab, Stephanie Schrag and John Mittler, a number of years ago, demonstrated that if, in fact, you start out with sensitive cells, they colonize the walls of the hemostats usually, and then we always have a minority population of sensitive feeding in. That's sort of the one of the hypotheses, that they're colonizing the walls and feeding in. Resistance is not absolute. There are a few functional receptors, so that resistance is not an absolute thing. And sensitive bacteria are continually produced. And what I'm going to do is we're calling it leaky resistance. And that is to say, sensitive bacteria are continually produced. That mutation rate argument, mutation transition rate argument. And I'm going to argue that this is the most likely hypothesis. And I'm going to show why we don't account for the others. But I'm going to provide evidence for this sensitive or continually produced from resistant cells. Without saying they'll come to the mechanism. Paul?
I wondered, maybe it's accounted for as a mechanistic explanation for D, but do you account for the possibility that there is some trade-off between, let's say, niche specialization and phage resistance or sensitivity?
Yeah, this one is much more reduced than that. We're thinking of cells frolicking about in liquid culture with they never even read about form sensing or any of that shit.
Or spatial structure.
We don't know any of that.
Right. I know that's an inconvenient reality.
With the cholera, they do. All right, so we're going to argue for this leaky resistance hypothesis, okay? All right, so the proposition, if they're a unique population and there's a sufficient rate of transition, the phage will be maintained. To test that, we isolated 11 independent resistant mutants. And we isolated an LV and initiated a series of cultures. So now we have resistant. So we take the cells that are defined as resistant by our criteria and ask whether the bacteria can establish populations with resistant cells. It turns out that in 8 maintained the phage and 3 lost the phage by, that is to say, the cells that are defined by resistance by this assay, if I take the phage and put the lytic phage in at a low density, the phages are maintained, despite the fact that they're resistant. So what it is coming out in support of the hypothesis that resistance is somehow leaking. All right? But the question is, how leaky does it have to be? And for that, we go to our models. So now we're going back to the models. And we have to ask, at what rate do we need this transition to maintain the phage? And so the answer turns out, so what I did was simply to do the simple model, and if the rate of transition, we're calling mu, is 10 to the minus 6, the phage would be lost. If it's 10 to the minus 5, the phage would be maintained. 10 to the minus 4, we would get stable maintenance. The same thing is true with 10 to the minus 5. So not only we're predicting that we're saying that the rate of transition to sensitivity has to be on the order of 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5. That's, even in Trump's time, that's a high mutation rate, you know, if in fact we're dealing with mutation. And so, but that's what the prediction is, that the rate of transition is that high.
And if you are changing the other parameters by twofold or tenfold,
yeah, we're assuming in this case no fitness costs, but even if we do, it doesn't matter unless the fitness cost is enormous. All right. So how do we estimate the rate of transition? We're not looking for the easy to estimate the rate of mutation to resistance. That's a simple fluctuation test. That's what Luria Delbruck did in 1943. But how do we estimate the rate of mutation or rate of transition from resistant to sensitive? Okay, you get 1,000 undergraduates with toothpicks, and then they just sort of pick every colony and estimate. Tacky. All right. So we did that. That's uncool and labor and toothpick intensive. But we had a real advantage, and then Walker's pointed that out, is lysogeny. That is, so we can ask, so we now we have the cells that are resistant to lambda. But we have lambda, we have wild type lambda with a kanamycin marker. Can these things form lysogens? And at what rate do they form lysogens? So we can ask the question without toothpicks. We can ask directly, what is the rate of lysogen formation of these 11 mutants? So it's a simple assay. All we have to do is we have these resistant cells, put lambda can in there, and ask whether or not they can form lysogens. And then ask what rate they form it. Because the model is predicting that they'd have to do it at a rate of about 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5. So we can ask that question. And so this is the simple model of lysogeny, in that we now have, these are the lysogens. They're being converted from sensitive cells, so that we assume the same basic model, but instead of have only lytic infections, we have a parameter lambda, which is the rate, likelihood of forming lysogens, and these are the lysogens. So we're starting out with resistant cells. These are the free phage. It's the same model, just extended to allow for temperate phage. And what the model predicts is, if the phage-resistant cells, they should be able to estimate the rate of mutation or transition from the rate of formation of lysogens. So that we can ask, not only does this hypothesis, the two elements to the hypothesis, one of which showing that we can evolve, that the phage could be maintained on resistant cells. And the other high thing is the rate of transition has to be on the order of 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5. And how do we get that quantitative thing? So this is what our models would say. That is, if in fact this would be the number of lysogens we would get. so that if it's on 10 to the minus 5, we get this many lysogens. If it's 10 to the minus 4, starting out with resistant cells, we get that many lysogens. So the prediction is we should be able to produce lysogens if, in fact, the hot rate is high enough. So that it would be observed that the rate of transition is on the order of 10 to the minus 5 per cell per hour or greater. So we did, we took all of these, we can, all of these resistant mutants can produce lysogens. So every resistant mutant was able to produce lysogens. And but some of them, the maintenance of the phage, some of them could maintain the phage, and then we can also ask whether the lysogens are sensitive. That is to say, sensitive to level lysogens is sensitive. In this one mutant, 3 out of 5 were sensitive. This mutant, 5 out of 5 were sensitive. That is to say, that is, are they sensitive to lambda vir? Meaning, so we're picking up those that are genetically, that have, that is, the, we're getting, asking whether or not they reverted genetically at that rate. And some of them certainly didn't. Some of them could maintain the phage, some of them could not. And this is, you know, with this 20 years ago, we would write this up in the American Naturalist and have some bullshit about mechanism in the discussion. And then that would be the end of it. We can't get away with that anymore. On the other hand, molecular biologists could get rid of, you know, they could write some bullshit in the discussion about evolution, and nobody seems to catch them on that. I mean, you know, and there's a wonderful parody of that. I think it's Leroy Hood, that is, you found the gene, you sequenced the gene, and you find nothing in gene bank. What do you have? You have a paper without a discussion. Just think about that. That is, you know, they make up some bullshit about evolution, they're fine. We can't get away with that. Okay? So, we're going to have to get at the mechanism in terms of what is happening. How are we accounting for this high rate of mutation? How are we accounting for this transition? And this work is still in progress, but I think I can give you somewhat of an answer. So we need to have a tribute to the mechanism mafia, okay? This is André Leboeuf, my hero, and he has this wonderful, Stent Watson and Cairns out there, this is a Feshra for Delbruck in 1968, where all the people are, and the phage and the origins of molecular biology. He asked him to describe the most significant contribution. And he says that a scientist should never attempt to judge the value of their own achievements, whether significant or not, but especially not. This is the golden rule of intellectual high. I put this on the site. This is this wonderful essay called The Prophage and I. But the other thing he ends up, prophage is a remarkable entity indeed, a molecule, I should say, for I have to be molecular. Who is not? I mean, I just found that, I always loved that particular phrase. So it's clear that we're going to have to ask, what are the nature of these mutations? And in these days, you know, and so we just did Sanger sequencing, low throughput, $5 or so sequencing, all right? And so now we can ask what those mutants are, okay? Some of them were nonsense mutants. Some of them, a number of them were duplications. Now we have two genes, LAMB, which is these are MOL plus, and then MOL T is a regulatory mutation. And so we're getting either LAMB or MOL T. There's a wonderful paper by Justin Myers and colleagues where they pushed it and lambda evolved another receptor site. We never saw that happen. Okay. So we saw a evolution, but we didn't see much coevolution. That is, the phage did not evolve in this situation. So we're getting some, many of them are duplications, all right? And so we have insertions, we have duplications, we have missense mutations. And so these are particularly interesting in that lysogens that were tensitive, that they lost the mutation causing resistance, and these, it seems to genetically revert back to wild type. So these were reverting back to wild type. These, we checked, one of the predictions of this, and this was a suggestion by Justin at the Gordon conference last week, a week ago, a half ago, whatever. that is, if we can estimate the rate of mutation back from this by asking whether or not they're sensitive, whether or not they can grow on maltose. And we did that, so we did a fluctuation experiment, and we estimated the rate of reversion of these duplications to mol plus, and it was about 3 times 10 to the minus 5. So right at the level we wanted to see. And so there we got the answer. But we don't have the full answer yet. Some of the transition from resistant to is due through true reversion. Some of it can be attributed to the excision of insertion sequences. Mutations, we'd like them to be base substitutions and so on, but I think that if we look at E. coli, there's a lot of insertion sequences that are generating variation from within. And some of the transition are sensitive phenotypically, presumably regulatory gene noise. And this is another point that I do want to make, is that we're now dealing with a lot of phenotypic variation. And we have to, Lynn will be talking about that on, that is to say, in the old days, a gene knew its place. A genotype was a phenotype and everybody was quite happy. And if it didn't, they used the word leaky and then you swept it under the rug. That was the end of it. In point of fact, we got to deal with that reality, is that there is a lot, and this is the phenomenon of persistence. That is to say, if I treat, this is Staph aureus, if we treat with, say, gentamicin, ciprofloxacin, rifampin, and so on, we get a high rate of killing, and then it levels off. These bacteria are, we could plate them, and there's some very nice work by Nathalie Balaban showing that these are basically non-replicating bacteria. And so, and therefore refractory to the antibiotics. If I take these and regrow them, we get the same result. That is to say, the whole phenomenon is phenotypic. This whole question of persistence is, in fact, a whole area of research. People love it. It's a shitty phenotype because the frequency is low. That is, and part of the talk I was going to give is when you treat with bacteriostatic antibiotics, you're getting the same basic phenomenon. These are refractory to antibiotics, so that if I put other antibiotics there, and so there's a couple of things. I really wanted to get the word copacetic into the title of a paper, and we finally did here. And so we're sort of, this sort of a review, an opinionated review about persistence. We're saying it's largely many different mechanisms. Shit happens. We get minority populations not growing, like mutation. So we're arguing there that it's like mutation, not necessarily an adaptive character. But what we're saying in the case of the phage, we're saying we're getting some sort of phenotypic resistance. Now, have we rejected the alternative hypotheses? We're presenting evidence in support of one hypothesis. All right, phage-resistant engenders a fitness course which allows the sensitive cells to replicate. All right? When we look at it in the model, for that to get the results we see, the fitness cost would have to be enormous, like 35% fitness cost. We don't see anything like that.
So if it's something like switching, doesn't there need to be some cost for the persistent phenotype to be favored? Because otherwise, you would want to evolve I mean, I guess if it's these transposons, you would want to evolve stable resistant phenotype.
Okay, yeah. No, no. The point about persistence, what we show is, and there was some paper by Ido Kussel and Stan Liebler showing that if persistence is common, at least theoretically, it can be maintained by bed hedge. It's called, for the molecular biologist, bed hedging is a mechanism. You know, without we know it's not. And we could show we did an experiment with, say, Bacillus subtilis, which produces when it goes into competence, the cells stop dividing, and we could show that if we pulse with antibiotics, we could favor competence development. On the other hand, when it's rare, let us say we have a genotype that produces persisters and a genotype that doesn't, and assume that there's a cost to the genotype that produces persisters, but if they're refractory to antibiotics. When they're common, they have an advantage. So that if you episodically, if you periodically kill, then they have an advantage. When they're rare, on the other hand, since the phenotype is all that much rare, they have no advantage. So they can't increase when rare. So that's why one of the reasons we're suggesting in that paper is that it's basically like mutation. Shit happens. We don't have to account for mutation. We don't have to explain. We have to explain mutation rate, but we don't have to explain mutation. And we're suggesting that persistence is like that. Okay, so that's whether it's important, and the talk I would have given was to argue that it really isn't very important for acute infections anyhow, even though it's a... There is a refuge on the wall. This is the hypothesis. So the first one says the fitness cost just has to be too high. The wall hypothesis may contribute to the maintenance of the phage, but we're stuck getting these experiments to work where the initial population is already resistant, so there's no minority population of sensitive to get on the walls. So that's inconsistent with this hypothesis. Resistance is not absolute. That is to say, there's a reduction in adsorption rate. For those of you that work with phage, you get mucoids. I don't know whether you've probably K12 does it. That's one of the reasons we work with E. coli B. Mucoids, these sort of snotty-looking colonies, they have a very low adsorption rate. You get high, in accord with the average rate of adsorption, would have to be very low. And if you're if it's too low, the phage cannot be maintained. And if it's somewhat lower, the phage would be maintained, but the phage would dominate. So we cannot explain our experimental results under that assumption. So basically we're saying we have evidence in support of leaky resistance, but now how general it is, whether that's going to be true for other phage, I don't know. Lambda was a great one to do it with because we had our lysogens. So we now have to look at the generality of that. So we're saying leaky resistance is really important. Now, the question of, do I have time?
No.
Okay. I apologize for yesterday. Okay.
If you're looking at the course, says another 10 minutes.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, it's really mainly for the course people because they have to be in the lab.
Okay. All right. Wait, who wants the lab, what's the word? Two?
Well, that's for the bioinformatic people, but for that one, it's only
and there are some groups that are meeting, I think, at 12:45.
But then presumably they will also have some bacterial culture for lunch. So when do you want to start?
With 10 minutes more. I mean, who needs lunch?
Okay. No cholera. No cholera, but temperance. Okay. I want to talk to the cholera. Under what conditions will temperate phage become established? And so we now have the extended model. We have a model for temperate phage, and this is the prediction that is, if in fact we have a low minority of temperate phage over the short term, this is the prediction. This is what observed. These are lysogens evolving. The phage come up, and sensitive cells. We would predict the loss of the sensitive cells. We don't observe the loss of the sensitive cells. But over, and that if we go over a series of transfers, the culture should be dominated by lysogens, and that's what we see. So the model is fine that way. We're okay with that. I don't know, I've got to put these things straight out. We put them all in. When we start out with lysogens invading the sensitive cells, we get results that are inconsistent with the prediction. The model doesn't fit. That is, we would expect new lysogens to dominate and the sensitive cells dominate. We haven't figured that one out. If, in fact, we start out with a low frequency of high frequency of lysogens, we're pretty good. So there's something we're really missing, and we haven't fully accounted for that yet. All right, under broad conditions, either with extreme viruses, the temperate phage will take over and will dominate, but it's not fully consistent with the dynamics. Temperate and lytic phage together. What happens if we have the resistant mutants? First of all, temperate excludes lytic. That's one possibility. Temperance prevails. Lytic exclude temperate. And lytic and temperate can coexist. Those are the three possibilities. And so when we did today, so we have the model where we have lytic and temperate and everything there, and the equations, and you're welcome to all of this if you want. And we haven't published it, but we soon will. And if in fact we're assuming this rate of transition, the culture should be dominated by resistant cells and resistant lysogens, and that they should coexist. And if in fact the rate is different, we're still, in both cases, we're predicting that if in fact lytic mutants evolved, we'd have resistant lysogens, and the temperate and lytic phage will be maintained. And when we did the experiments, that's basically what we saw. We ended up with putting lytic and temperate phage together with sensitive cells. The cultures are dominated by bacteria, and because of resistance is evolving, and temperate and lytic phage are maintained. And if we provide an advantage for the lysogeny by putting in a little bit of kanamycin, because remember, then temperate and lytic phage are maintained. So going back to the original question, what we're saying is if virulent phage evolve, you're not going to get rid of lysogeny, but they're both going to be maintained. So there's concern about whether lysogeny would be lost. The answer is no, at least in our experiments. So this is where we are. In accord with our model, temperate and lytic phage can and will coexist. The equity prevails. How can you do better than that? I was going to talk about the cholera, but it looks like we have time limits on that, and I won't talk about the cholera. Any questions about this? And you're welcome to all the PowerPoints.
So how important is the serial transfer regime? The serial transfer regime. If you put this into a chemostat.
No, this was all in serial transfer.
Yeah, but if you put it into a chemostat, how important is the serial transfer regime?
I don't know. We've done it years ago. We did it, and what happens in chemostats, resistant lysogens evolve. And then so that you have resistant lysogens, so you're maintaining the temperate phage in the form of resistant lysogens. Okay. We should do it in chemostats, but what we're doing, Paul, is to me, what I tried to point out yesterday is, what about physical structure?
I completely agree, but I wonder how much the physical structure or the temporal dynamic of the lag There's the potential there for a lot of trade-offs.
I agree. I could tell you, WACOS has been doing it in physical structure now, and it looks much more stable. Everything looks much more stable. And by physical structure, we're looking at they're growing as colonies, and the phage are infecting colonies. And so physical structure seems to stabilize things right now. And I'm not surprised, actually. You're not either.
Chris, why in all of these experiments, and everybody who's looked at them, do the bacteria win? Like, why do the arms races stop with the bacteria being, excluding phage completely, at least being...
There was a paper, Paul, you did that paper years ago with Angus Buckling, where you saw more co-evolution than we see.
And he took that on a lot further and got at least the sequencing details. So it did provide strong evidence that it happens. And there are some mechanistic explanations that do involve, first of all, you've got all of the spatial structure and therefore many different diverse types. And there are, and some work that we did a couple of years ago showed a very interesting trade-off between one kind of poor performing niche specialist and resistance, and a higher quality niche specialist and sensitivity that would give you, actually, in that system alone, with just those two types, opportunity for...
But are you getting a really continuous arms race?
Well, the data from Angus' subsequent work...
You didn't do the genetics then.
It wasn't done, but it was done with tens of thousands of individual colonies with the street test at that stage. But Angus and his team subsequently looked at both the phage and the host and captured the dynamic in the DNA sequence of a co-evolutionary arms race involving multiple different loci that in many cases are also implicated, at least, in colonization of the air-liquid interface. Remember, there's all that ecological complexity that's there. Yeah. And it does require the spatial structure.
It does require the spatial structure, whereas the CRISPR, where we know we're getting that co-evolution, we're still dominated by immune cells.
Yeah.
So the question is, in reality, are we dominated by immune cells? I don't know.
Well, no, but I mean, this one experiment aside, the majority of these kinds of experiments that I've seen, maybe I'm not misreading the literature, you get limited arms races, you get one or two cycles, and then it stops because the bacteria become resistant, the phage can't go any further.
But don't you think there's an issue about resources, that in those experiments, resources are usually pretty high, while in nature may be much shorter, and so the cost of resistance may become much stronger in those environments? And
I think I don't know the answer to it. I don't know. It can't be that the phage... It doesn't seem reasonable to think that the phage are running out of mutational options for getting around. I mean, in Justin's paper is a good example. I mean, although it was really hard selection, and they really,
what I really like about this is a big question. These are big questions. I mean, we know, the most dominant organism on Earth. Unfortunately, none of them voted for Trump. I want to make it clear. We don't know what they're doing. I mean, there are these wonderful unanswered questions out there.
They're not even winning the popular vote.
Well, hopefully they'll become more popular. That is what I think is really cool about this meeting. I'm just sort of saying that there's some wonderful, big, unanswered questions, and particularly now with the sort of microbiome mania. How much of phage... How important the phage in this whole process? And we're going to have to get away from flasks and get out there, I'm afraid. Out there, well, we go to the sewage treatment plant, but that's not really where you want to be.
So this also comes back to where you begin to say there are 10 times as many phage, this sort of bullshit number you got from the web, right, that you cited.
Right.
But I mean, that's in certain environments, right? In the water, is it clear that it might be in other environments that bacteria are dominating?
What I'd love to know in the case of cholera, if we went out there, are we going to find that population is dominated by resistant cells? I mean, that's, you know, and which is what we see experimentally. And I was going to show the cholera stuff where we have that. And the other thing I was going to show in the cholera stuff, when you get, you evolve resistance, they become avirulent. And we've seen this in other cases as well. They lose motility, and they're no, well, the assay, you might not think it's a great assay in terms of C. elegans as an assay for virulence of cholera. I mean, my graduate students weren't willing to swallow it. You know, they're not as serious as they were in the past. But so we used C. elegans, and the resistant ones were less virulent. So that's another aspect of this whole question. We saw that with E. coli K1. We're seeing that with staph. That is, resistance is really engendering a cost in virulence, which makes a positive thing for using phage. Anyway, I hope I've induced interest in phage, because I think there's lots of great stuff and big unanswered questions.